So, everyone, and welcome to the last of this term's particle physics seminars. We're very happy to have Simon Nabham here from Berkeley, who's going to tell us about fishing for new physics at the LHC.
All right. Okay, thank you for having me here today. This is some work on two papers, which are, as we'll see, are unrelated. They're all with fully Berkeley people, so Tim Liu, Tong Yan Lin, and Tom Melia for the first one. And the second one is Michele Papucci and Dean Robinson, and Simone, who is on Atlas. All right, so we have over the last many years, or decades, if you want, found all sorts of ways of decorating the standard model with all sorts of extensions that each have their own motivation and purpose. Of course, we don't expect to see all of them at once, right? But this is sort of like, yeah, a small overview. However, in the last couple of years, we were blessed, if you will, with a huge amount of data from the LHC. And we have searched thousands and thousands of channels, and so far we just have limits. There's a few very minor things right now. We have one major excess kind of thingy, which unfortunately has passed away as from this summer. So we're given some false hope. It was just like an excess in a diphoton channel at 750 GeV. Many of us were hopeful about, but alas, is no longer there. Now, so that begs the question, what do you do next? And so I think there is sort of like, that's a sort of general framework, very roughly speaking, there are four sort of paths, more or less, that you can do. You can say, okay, you know, let's just keep calm and carry on, right? Most of the data will still come. There's no reason whatsoever to panic. And this is one attitude which is perfectly valid, especially if you're interested in precision physics and the standard model physics. And certain BSM searches are not, as far as the 13 TV data is concerned, are not done yet, right? So there's still no reason yet for panic. You could say, well, let's look at other experiments, intensity frontier, maybe like more future experiments. You can work on that, or dark matter. You can try to broaden your models, try to see, okay, you know, the things that we have looked for over there are really didn't seem to materialize. So are there other models that are also well motivated, which are not naturally give you the signatures that we have been looking for, and do give you different signatures? And then finally, you could say, well, let's start from the experiment itself and say, are there certain what are we actually really good at, and can we advance those frontiers and make sure that we really maximally exploit the capabilities that we currently have? And so I think all of these things are obviously useful, and we need to try to, as a field, diversify as much as possible. But so for the talk today, we're going to go along this avenue, which is sometimes you may call like a fishing expedition, right? So why would we go fishing, right? So if you say, if you're someone who likes the glass half empty, then you say, well, okay, you're going on your fishing expedition, and the result is going to be another limit, right? So you're going to set another limit on some scenario that you didn't necessarily, what do you learn from that? But if you're like me and you see the glass half full, you say like, well, you know, we got some very fancy fishing equipment, right? And so we really want to make sure that we fully utilize it to the extent that we can. And this is specifically important to the LHC because triggers are very crucial things, right? So if you don't... Well, I mean, it's the fanciest that I'm aware. It's very fancy compared to that. You cast your net as wide as possible. I didn't want to say those words because it's a bit cliche, but like that's essentially what we do. We want to make sure there's no holes in the net, which corresponds to things that, you know, go unnoticed at the LHC because we didn't trigger on them and the data is just thrown away, right? So that's one motivation. But then also, like, you know, what are things that we can do which we should just like make sure that we have it covered? I think, yeah, the reason why this is interesting is because there's a lot of, I think, exciting experimental developments in the last couple of years that we can take advantage of. All right, so I'm going to talk about two different things. They are completely unrelated, so I'll give you that up front. The first thing is an idea to use the LHC Heavy Ion program to search for new physics, which has been tried before, but I think we have the first case where it actually works and we actually beat the proton-proton collisions. And then the second thing is a trigger for is an online analysis that we're proposing for certain hidden valley type models. So the idea here is that you're doing your analysis on the trigger level, essentially, before even writing out the data to take, at least partially. And that's also a new thing. All right, so let's start with this one. So as you probably have heard many times, the LHC has a very nice heavy ion program going. And the LHC heavy ion program is not designed for new physics. It's really they're looking for to study quark gluon plasma. They do proton lead collision and lead lead collisions, which is what we're going to be interested in. And just to give you a sense on what the luminosity is, so we have like about half an inverse nanobarn from 2015 did. Now, just an interesting heavy ion trivia. Why is the luminosity so low in these collisions? And there's multiple reasons. But one reason which I think was surprising to me, which is kind of cute, is that there's this particular process where you have two fully ionized lead ions coming in. You pop an E plus E minus pair from the vacuum, and it binds to one of the ions. So what you end up having is an 81 plus and a positron coming out. And this process has a cross-section of 250 barns, right? So usually we measure stuff in picobarns. This is in barns. And what it does is, because the magnetic rigidity of this thing here is different, it eventually hits the beam pipe. And it turns out what happens is this induces about a 30-watt current in one of the dipole magnets 140 meters down the road. And if you crank up the luminosity more, it just quenches the magnet. Right? So they're trying to install some quadrupole magnets to diffuse this thing out, to reduce sort of thing. But that's like one of the limiting factors right now. No, but like it essentially doesn't deplete the beam in a significant way, but it does. Yeah, it just happens to quench a magnet 140 meters down the line, which you don't want, of course. Yeah, it's very bad. And so that's one of the things that limits the luminosity at this point, because they're not close to like having pileups, which is also something they wouldn't want. Anyway, but the point is, all four experiments participate, even Atlas and CMS, and they even have a little bit more data than Elise. And the number you keep in mind is they have roughly 10 to the minus 4 times less data in terms of raw collisions than proton-proton collisions have. All right. So what I'm going to care about are ultra-peripheral collisions, which are very high-impact parameter collisions where the two ions essentially pass by each other without breaking up. Because like this is what a head-on collision looks like in CMS. Like, it's a huge mess. Try extracting new physics from this. It's not going to happen, right? But in these ultra-peripheral collisions, what happens is the ions go down the pipe, and you produce a couple, maybe a handful of particles, and the collision in your event is actually extremely clean, right? So this is secretly a cosmic ray event, because I didn't have any event displays of this thing, but this sort of gives you a sense sort of to set the contrast between your usual head-on collision. So we're going to care about this, and we have some good theoretical control over these things. The reason why I care is because the electric charge of these things is huge, it's 82. And the photon-photon flux in these collisions, you can do a photon-photon collision, scales like z to the fourth, which is 7 orders of magnitude in this case, on top of what you have for a proton-photon collision. So this is, here you see the cross-section of light-by-light scattering. We'll talk about more later. So this is for proton-protons. You see there's a 7 orders of magnitude difference in cross-section for lead, just because you take advantage of this extremely high electric charge of these ions. And so what's neat is that this is essentially a QED in a non-perturbative regime, right? So there's a non-perturbative theory, but because it's an abelian theory, we're lucky and we know what we do with this sort of thing. But if you look at it, this one, the Tove coupling in some sense is much larger than in QCD, which is kind of cute. Which is, of course, the explanation of this 250 barn cross-section that we earlier. Now, so what can I do? So as far as BSM is concerned, usually we're interested in like more massive stuff, right? And so you want to ask, like, what's the hardest photon that I can pull off from one of those heavy ion collisions? And so the hardest photon essentially corresponds to, because I want to coherently see the entire ion, so what is the wavelength of the photon needs to be roughly of the same size as the Lorentz contracted size of the ion. And if you sort of work this out, this is in absolute numbers. For a proton-proton, if you want to keep the proton intact, you can go to 1 TeV, 1.5 TeV, and 160 GeV is sort of roughly the hardest photon you can extract from like a heavy ion collision without breaking the ion apart. Now, one point to notice here is that when usually when people specify the energy of a collision, they say something like 5.5 TeV. Now, that's the energy of the collision per nucleon, right? But so that means that if you treat the nucleus as like an object as a whole, which is what we're doing here, this is really a 1,000 TeV collider, right? So there's like 208 nuclei in this system. And so we're interested in very, very low Bjork connects, essentially. That's the regime where we're going to be in. So if someone asks you, we need a 1,000 TeV collider, we already have one. Fortunately, you know, different elements would be nice, but okay. All right. So how do you compute the photon-photon flux for this thing? So this is sort of a cartoon. Now I'm looking like along the beam, right? So this ion is going this way. The other one's coming towards us. These blue things are sort of roughly the electric field lines that go radially outwards. And there's this essentially ancient calculation of the photon-photon flux as a function of the energy and the impact parameter. So this is something.
This is for a specific nuclear form factor?
No, not yet. So I'll talk about the form factor in a second. This is at distances sufficiently far away from the nuclei that you don't care. So this is the expression for a point particle at this point, right? So this is the Weizsäcker-Williams calculation. So essentially, what you're doing is you're replacing these electric fields with an equivalent flux of photons, right? This is an idea which goes back to Fermi. And these k things here are just Bessel functions. But what matters is that essentially it depends, of course, on the impact parameter b, and it scales like z squared. And what you're going to do to calculate the flux for these ultraperiphal collisions, you're doing the photon-photon luminosity. So you're doing the same thing as you do to calculate the gluon luminosity function for protons, except for a few different things. Fluxes here you can think of as PDFs, like you have a gluon PDF or proton-proton. This is the photon PDF, except that it also depends on the impact parameter. So you have to integrate over the impact parameter. And then you're sticking in a nuclear form factor over here, which is going to set this flux to zero as soon as either the photon comes from inside of one of these nuclei or when the nuclei overlap. And all the nuclear physics uncertainty sits in this thing over here. So for the contribution which comes from B1 and B2 sufficiently far away from the nuclei is really just quantum electrodynamics, and so you don't really have any nuclear uncertainty on this thing. And so, yeah, that means that especially for relatively low energy photons, the uncertainty is, the flux is really dominated by long distances, and the uncertainty is very well under control. This stuff is, of course, been known for a while, and this has been implemented in this Monte Carlo program, Starlight, which they use for the star experiments and at Brookhaven, and now also at the LHC. So what we did is we implemented axion production in this program, and so we passed it to them, and so they now included this in their next version. So you can download this thing, and you can run axion production Monte Carlo at the LHC or at RIC if you want. Anyhow, that's just like a detail. This program accounts for like realistic nuclear form factors and so on. But you can show that for anything below 100 GeV invariant mass, you don't really care. It doesn't really, it makes only 2% difference. And above 100 GeV, it grows like 30%, depending on what form factor you put in. All right, so some applications. This is my favorite application, which unfortunately doesn't work. This is also fairly old stuff by Bob Kahn and Dave Jackson. So they and other people noticed that, well, you could try to look for the Higgs in photon fusion in heavy ion collisions, right? Which is a really neat idea. So unfortunately, and so notice here that the scale, they still had SSC on the axis. So for the LHC, we care, we're roughly over here, and so you have a cross-section of like 20 to 30 picobarns with a 1 inverse nanobarn luminosity. Unfortunately, we can't get there, it's a shame. These two different lines are really one of the earliest calculations that just assume the point-like nucleus. And so these guys put in like a form factor. And so if you don't put in any form factor, you get it wrong by a lot. But then what form factor exactly you put in doesn't matter as long as you get the nuclear radius more or less right. But you can't treat it as a point particle either. That doesn't work. Anyway, so this was cute. It doesn't work. What does work is JSI production, for instance, or Rho meson production. So what ends up happening is you have a photon coming off from the nucleus, which essentially mixes into an off-shell vector boson, a QCD vector boson, composite state, which then scatters through by emitting a bunch of gluons, it scatters almost elastically with the nucleus, the other nucleus, and gets kicked onto the mass shell without breaking out one of the nuclei. So there is sort of this ladder of gluons that's coming in here. These are two results from Elise, but Atlas and CMS can do the same thing. These guys just have a really awesome mass resolution. You really see the JSI peak here very beautifully. And this is for raw mesons, the King pions. And notice again, the units are in barns, so these are enormous cross sections. And they start seeing a hint of the F1270, which is cute.
Is this just a statistical fluctuation, or is it some second?
This one?
No, or
that?
The shoulder,
this feature on the shoulder here, I'm not sure. Sorry, I don't know. I would say, I think it's probably statistical fluctuation. I mean, their error bars here are not entirely, this is for a very small amount of data, because like the cross sections are huge, but this is one of the first things they do when they run this experiment. This is still only like, they should be able to update this now. Maybe they have already done it, I missed it. Anyway, some very cute standard model physics you can do, and you can try to learn something about this process here, about the decomposition, the gluon density in some sense of the nuclei. And then finally, one very nice application is you can do light-by-light scattering. So essentially, it's just photon fusion going through a box and then going back to photon fusion. And so this has been pointed out by these people. These guys did some more precise calculations, and you see that for roughly one inverse nanobar, you expect a handful of events. Yeah, these are
essentially at all.
Yes, so they go down the beam pipe, so you don't see them. Now there's one exception in the sense that there's something called a giant magnetic dipole moment, in the sense that if you go through such a collision, you can really excite the nucleus, and it can emit a couple neutrons down the road. And those neutrons you can see 140 meters down the beam pipe in the Roman plot detectors. So they have like some very tiny detectors, like essentially in the beam pipe. So the beam goes through these detectors that they can tag these neutrons with. And then you know they had an ultraperiphal collision. And they can use it for triggering, but there's other triggers that we'll discuss. This is quite cute. But yeah, so this is light-by-light scattering. It's essentially as simple as it seems. I mean, you know, once you know the gluon luminosity, you can calculate this. The photon luminosity, you can calculate this, what they did.
And they can tell those apart from just...
Yes, we'll talk about that. Yeah, or I will mention it, and if I don't, then ask again. Ramstrahling essentially is just very, very forward.
Okay,
I'll just go down the
beam.
Yeah, so this is very wide. So I mean, our idea is like as stupid as you think it is. It's just like, okay, you know, if you can do this, then you can look for axions, right? Axion-like particles. They're not real axions in the dark matter sense. But just like essentially like a scalar or pseudoscalar which couples to photons, you can make it in photon fusion, decays back to two back-to-back photons, and you can look for a resonance. And we're specifically interested in sort of saying something about this gap over here, above a few GeV down to 100 GeV, up to 100 GeV-ish. That's sort of the energy regime that we're interested in. This possibility has been pointed out a long time ago, but it was never really implemented as like a realistic sort of thing at the LHC. So how do you trigger on this thing? So CMS,
before you go,
yes.
This is assuming that it couples with
photons? I do both. I'll show you the limits for both. So I assume that it couples with photons. It could also couple to other things. That only affects the other limits that are already there. Yes. You have other, there's other constraints that you can get. Yeah, well, yeah. But so for this purpose, like, we just care about photon photons. So you can trigger on this thing. They can trigger down to 2 GeV photons, two of these photons, which sounds completely ludicrous if you're like sort of used to LHC physics. Usually photon triggers are like 20, 30 GeV, right? The reason is that these events are really, really clean, right? And so they're essentially just looking for like something above the noise threshold of the color emitter. And apparently the rate is small enough that they can get away with this. Provided they put a veto on the forward color emitters, which would be violated as soon as the ions overlap, because there's going to be lots of tracks.
If you had the axions, say, having couplings to fermions that could feed to electrons or something.
Yes.
You would also be able to get similarly.
Yeah, you could trigger on that too. Now, we'll discuss, like the background is absolutely fabulous. The E plus E minus background is kilobarns. So you know you're not gonna get there. Maybe taus if you want. Yeah, but the backgrounds are enormous. Yes. So LHC great detectors, but the events are essentially as clean as lead, which is cute. So you can trigger down very low. Yeah. I don't see why not. I mean, like they can do it at the LHC. Oh, what do you mean by reconstruct out the case? Yeah, the tech, it's the same as protons, right? So yeah, so they can, I mean, I don't think they will be Bell or LHCb or something like that in the sense that you have to work with the tracker that you have, but I mean, you can reconstruct tau, so no problem. So they measure the tau cross section, for instance, if that's what you're, yeah. All right, so this is our result. So the green thing is light by light scattering. It's our calculation of light by light scattering. We just use this result from these guys, fold it in with the photon PDFs. This blue thing is you produce E plus E minus central and you misidentify both of them as photons. So the tracks are lost somehow. So this is an experimental background. And this last thing is Bremsstrahlung, which is a really sort of kind of wacky topology where both electrons either are missed or they go down the beam pipe, but they happen to both Brem like two hard photons back to back in a very small phase space, which is why it's essentially negligible. But given that, you know, you start off with kilobarns, you know, you have to check all this sort of weird stuff up. And so as soon as you're going above 20 GV, this is roughly for one inverse nanobarn, you're essentially background free. There is no background event at all for this sort of thing. So these are the projected limits that so the sort of projected sensitivity for one inverse nanobarn and 10 inverse nanobarn. This is where we only assume couplings to photons, and here we couple to hypercharge. So we normalize stuff such that what's plotted over here is really the coupling to FF tilde. So these limits are the same. What changed is, in this case, you have stronger limits from other sources. Right? Most of these things are things that we recasted ourselves. For instance, in this case, you have a distribution from exotic Z decays and stuff like that. So you see that, especially in this case, you do quite a bit better. In this case, it's more or less competitive with what you currently have in proton-proton. One cute thing I want to point your attention to is this red line over here. This is CMS did also the search where they looked for two photons in exclusive proton-proton collisions, essentially exactly the same process. They have to do that in an essentially pileup-free environment, which is why this is very low data. But this is an actual limit over here from the CMS data. Is of course not competitive with proton-proton, but if you scale it with z squared, you essentially get what you expect for, and then with the luminosity, you essentially get what you expect for a lead.
Masses below 10 GeV, you probably start getting constraints from
E plus E minus collisions. Yeah, so as far as I'm aware, like the constraints over here, this is
up to 10 minus 1 GeV. So if you have B factors run up to 10 GV, right? So
you're
very weak sensitivity at 10
yeah.
GV,
yeah.
Right? So but you can I mean this photon fusion program, right?
At
Bar and Bell, and they have pretty sensitive.
Yeah, as far as I know, they don't beat the lab constraints, but maybe I'm not aware of the right. I'd be happy to be up there.
Yeah, have analyzed it, right?
Yeah.
The blank search.
Yeah.
One possibly can get much better, right?
If you have like let's say a 10 GeV collision, right? Your photon flux falls off fairly fast once you sort of push towards the regime where
they've done it with electron positron goes down the pipe,
yep.
And the other one is scattered through.
Oh, yeah, yes.
You see that, and yes. Then in addition, you right. See the two photons from
yeah.
From that.
Right. So essentially, yeah, you try to recoil against the ISR and you have a threefold.
Right. And all the normal candles that give two photons, they have form factors falling down
right.
into square. And so you have a particle that will be doing something that has
inverse TEV.
TEV, and that includes the loop factor, right?
This includes the loop factor.
Right.
Yeah,
so
oh, yeah, okay, that would be interesting to look at, yeah. But it's essentially the same thing as what LAP did, but then right. That's
it's there because they don't book in their data until you tell them what to look for.
Yeah. Although, I mean, if you're perfectly honest with yourself, like this sort of values of the coupling constant, once you put in the loop vector, it starts to be really like. But once you look, yeah, it would be great, yeah. Just like to finish on that point, like the reason why we're cutting off at 5 GeV is just because of the triggers at Atlas and CMS. So we try to do associated production or like, you know, by bramming off, like by just introducing another state, but then the cross section really drops quickly below to what you can get. The limits are not competitive to LAP anymore at that point. All right, so just to wrap this up, Atlas did the search recently, so it came out like a few weeks or maybe a month ago. They had half an inverse nanobarn of data. And so there it is, right? Light-by-light scattering has been discovered in the standard model once again. At the 4.4 sigma, I call it a discovery because it's the standard model. It's fine. The rate is consistent and whatnot. So you see here, this red is light-by-light. These are the fakes. And this purple thing is like a QCD background, which they estimate slightly higher than us. But in the end, it doesn't really matter for the limit. So we can set a limit using this data. And so this is what we find using the Atlas data. We have this sort of limit here, which is statistically driven, these wiggles. So we should have probably, because they didn't plot the data above 30 GeV, assuming they don't have any events, right? Because they would have probably claimed something. You can extrapolate this line essentially on parallel with the green line to get the actual limit. So for this case, where you just couple two photons, we set the best limit in this scenario here. It's more or less competitive with other limits that you have. And so any other scenario or interpolation between these things. All right, that's it for axions. So there's a couple other things you could try.
So if we do by just a couple of photons, we mean that we're not having the Z uplift as well that you get from the B.
That's right. So yeah, I tuned those off.
But to get that, we need to have the W's.
That's right.
And then therefore you get the limits of W's.
Yeah, so there is a Tongyan and Brian and Eder put out a paper very recently. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah.
So that, as I recall, that's like for this region over here, right? Like the WW region.
Yeah, that's cuts on about 5 GB. But
less than that,
probably
4. So, one thing you could in principle try at LHC as well is, for instance, W, associate production of a W with two photons, for instance. Right, so I don't think that search has been done, but it's something that one could, in principle, do. Now, in general, let me leave it at that. We can discuss that a little bit more later. All right. Anyway, there's other things that you may be able to do, some of which we are looking into. But the upshot is that the events are very clean, and you have LHC-grade detectors, which are really excellent. So there's, and then maybe there's something to do with at least you have final stage with leaf tracks. But for photons, they're useless because they don't have a complete perimeter. All right. Any more pressing questions on ultra-peripheral collision? You can always get back to it later. Otherwise, I'll continue this thing. Let me just get started, right? So here the idea is we want to look for a particular type of hidden valley, which is currently completely unconstrained. And again, like in hidden valleys, so most of you are probably familiar with the setup. What happens is you produce like a heavy state, or there's some irrelevant operator, which dumps a bunch of energy in a hidden sector. There's some complicated dynamics happen. There's a bunch of light degrees of freedom, which then eventually decay back to the standard model. It could either be prompt or displaced, but typically the multiplicity is somewhat higher than what you would have in like a typical BSM event. And again, like for this sort of thing, like your triggers are important. You need to make sure that you're not having anything slip through the net, they say, poetic. All right, so especially Atlas has been, they've been doing quite a bit of things already, as you can see in the sort of summary slide, as far as hidden values are concerned. These are mostly focused for displaced searches, and in the regime where the coupling in the hidden value is not that strong, to the extent that you still form jets, dark jets. So they're sort of collimated objects. So what we want to look for is, can we look for the regime where the coupling in the hidden value is very strong? It's stronger than QCD to the extent that there is no collinear and soft enhancement for splitting. Right? In QCD, the coupling in most of the shower is still sufficiently weak that you benefit from either showering a soft gluon or like a collinear gluon, which means that you end up with sort of a jet-like object in the end. But if your coupling is very strong, essentially every splitting in the shower will just be like you split into two particles with a random angle and with more or less equal energy. And then the event looks essentially like a spherical ball of soft stuff, right? So you're really in bad shape for seeing this thing because it's really difficult to trigger on this thing. There's no jets, there's nothing, it's really hard because the shower is super efficient. And so right now there is really nothing to look for this kind of thing. We don't really know. So here, just like full disclosure, additional assumptions that I'm putting in. So we decided to neglect fluctuations away from sphericity because we don't know. Nobody, as far as I know, knows how to calculate that. And also, we want to be maximally conservative. So we don't want to introduce jets when there are none. For the PT distribution of the final particles, final state particles, we assume a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, which is something that's been argued from ADS, CFT, and the large N limit. You can show that this is, and this is also reproduced in some QCD systems. To some extent, we can talk about it more. We assume that everybody decays prompt, again, mostly for simplicity and because we don't want to bias ourselves towards a more easily visible signature, so there's no missing energy. And so just if you really care, the way we do that is the hidden sector mesons, they're of the order of a GeV, decay to two dark photons, and then they decay back to the standard model in a fashion that's from. But, yeah. It depends. So if the lifetime is such that a significant fraction of the particles decay outside the collider, you can trigger on missing energy. And in that case, it's probably easy to trigger on, right? So what we're looking at here is triggers. The case where like they essentially all decay in the tracker but not prompt is a little bit more tricky. And so it's something that we want to do in the future. But so there, yeah, there are some ideas that we have there which we can discuss in the end if you want. There, I'm not sure that this is the easiest thing. All right. And then, for simplicity, we have things only decay to electrons and muons. But the analysis that we're proposing would also work if you have a real dark photon where there is also pion decay modes, we think. But we're also going to investigate that further later. And then finally, we, for most of our benchmarks, we pick gluon fusion for production just because you have to pick some. But it could be Q-bar fusion as well. So in summary, what you have is you have gluon fusion, some heavy scalar, which decays into a very strongly showering hidden sector. So high multiplicity of particles come out, a bunch of mesons in the end, and then they all decay back to standard model states. And so for simplicity, again, we assume that there's just a single meson at the end which dominates this hadronization process. All right. And one of our benchmarks is we take this to be the Higgs, so that this is an exotic Higgs decay. So triggers, I don't know how much you guys have looked into triggers. I hadn't really before this thing. So Atlas and also CMS, they have two levels of trigger. One is the level is a hardware trigger, where essentially the detector by itself decides what it's going to do with the event, right? So it's really inside the detector. There's decisions being made. You can only use the calorimeter and the muon chambers because there's no time to read out the entire tracker. There's just too many channels. And they can now do some, on the detector level, do some combine some objects, so jet-like objects, and then count and do some sort of global detector style things. And so an example here is for the 3 muon trigger at level 1. This is just you require one muon of 15 GeV, which gives you a rate of roughly 7 kilohertz. And if you go to the high-level trigger, now the data is brought to the surface and processed in the farm above the detector. There's like a big computer farm that does that. You have access to the tracker as well. You can do some amount of event reconstruction, Not everything, that takes too much time. There's some stuff you can do. And for instance here, again, for the 3 muon trigger, the threshold is raised to 18 and then 4 and 4 for the 2 other muons, which beats down the rate about 2 hertz. That's sort of an example of like the kind of things that you you expect. And as far as the soft bomb is concerned, there is no trigger right now which would really efficiently look for this thing, because it looks very closely like pileup unless you do something more concrete. And if you care about finding all these triggers, they're all publicly available now, at least for Atlas. You can look this up. So what is the strategy? So at level one, we don't want to mess with what they already do, because it's really hardware. We don't want to pretend we know how to modify that stuff. And so we try to look for an ISR jet or for missing energy. So how do we get missing energy is because many of these particles, even though everybody decays prone, they're sort of soft and they spiral in the magnetic field, and they don't all make it to the colorimeter. And so the colorimeter thought it saw MET because it doesn't know yet about the tracker. And so you can fool it to trigger on MET. And at a high level trigger, we have the inner tracker, and we're gonna look at like a pattern of hits on the inner layer of the tracker, and we can trigger on that very efficiently. This is our simulation. What you need to remember is that we put in 50 pileup vertices, which is twice as many as what they're currently running on. This is just to be conservative for the rest of the run. And we account for beam spread. So all these vertices, of course, are different positions in Z. It's roughly 45 millimeters. There's a Gaussian at 45 millimeters that we put in. And this will matter for our triggering strategy. This is what an event looks like truth level. So green are hadrons, so there's no pileup in this thing. Green are hadrons, so you see here there's an ISR jet. Blue are leptons, and it's recoiling as like a cloud of very soft leptons. So you can nicely see that in the plot. This is the number of tracks, just to give you a sense of how many tracks I have in each of these different benchmarks. Of course, depends a bit on the confinement scale that you chose, which is a GEV for us. And about roughly, for instance, like the 751, you have like 1,500 tracks, half of which are in the acceptance of the tracker. So you're talking about like a couple of 100 extra tracks to like 1,000 extra tracks. So if you have the event on tape, it's pretty spectacular, and you reconstruct it, and you see like, okay, look, you know, something really went, was going on over here. Yeah?
Just to make sure I'm understanding, you know, if I just produced a bomb,
That's right. That's right.
So what you're saying is, you know, I think shoot off, you know, an ISR go on or something like that, and then I make the bomb in the event, and then it's the sort of jet plus mass signal that I'm triggering on. So it's
at level one, yes. At high level trigger, you need to do something else because the MET trigger really degrades a lot at the HLT. So then there's a lot of extra quality requirements which would really kill this thing again. But we'll do something else to bypass that. So the upshot is that if you have this thing today, it's essentially trivial. You just reconstruct the thing and say, okay, there's like 1,000 tracks coming from one vertex. I mean, this is obvious, right? But getting it to tape is really difficult because you don't have tracking, the whole tracking information while the thing is running. There's no time to reconstruct the entire event. So this is what, now you're going to hear a theorist describe the Atlas Inner Tracker. I'm sorry in advance. This is what the Atlas Inner Tracker looks like. The inner part is the pixel detector, which is most useful to us. They have like silicon strips over here, and then there's a position radiation tracker, which is essentially some sort of gas chamber that sits over there. In other words, and then this white space here, the colorimeter, electromagnetic colorimeter starts. So these are all the components that we include in our simulation. We're going to care about the IBL, which I'll explain in a second. We account for bremsstrahlung for the electron. So if an electron hits one of these, any of these elements that we put in, it's going to brem off a photon and slightly changes direction, changes energy, and continue to propagate in the magnetic field. It will also drop a little bit of energy, right? So also muons and pions, everything will just drop a little bit of energy whenever it crosses some of these layers. You don't care about this if the particles are hard, because it's a very small fraction of the total energy. But if you're interested in tracks of a few hundred MeV, this is a non-negligible effect, which is why we have to code up the simulation. All right. This is a perhaps more sort of different cross-section of what the Atlas tracker looks like. Same stuff, this is the inner pixel detector. There's an extra layer here, which is called the insertable B layer, the IBL, which is new from 2014, which is not shown here, which is essentially just an extra layer very close to the beam pipe, which is the one I'm going to care about for this. But all of these components are included in the simulation because they contribute to the energy loss of the particles. All right. So we talked about level one missing energy. So we propagate all these particles through the magnetic field, account for the energy loss, whatnot. And then we see, okay, who makes it to the colorimeter? Both the Bremsed photons and the actual particles. And we can calculate the missing energy based on that. Just here what you see for these two different benchmarks. And this gray line here is the turn-on curve for the MET trigger at level one, which essentially means that this is, for a given, if the missing energy is like roughly 150 GeV or almost 100% efficient, and then here the efficiency drops down. So we also account for this turn-on curve, which essentially you fold in, you do this integral, you fold this in with these things. And you find that, you know, you have 5 to 10% efficiency, which is not great, but it's really not that bad either, given that before it was zero, right? And we do the same thing for jets. Jets work a little bit better, just because it turns out that the trigger is just a little, you can get away with a little bit lower threshold for the trigger. But the idea is exactly the same. And we look also at a bunch of other triggers, which I didn't have plots for, but the principle is the same. And we put everything in one table for associated production vector boson fusion. Gluon.
Efficiency of 10 to 20% for these heavy guys. For Higgs, it gets really bad. For gluon fusion, it's not so bad for vector boson fusion, simply for associated production, because now you're essentially triggering on the muon or the jet from the WBC. And if you add that in with cross sections, you find that gluon fusion is still better than the others, but they're kind of, or they're also considered. But if you have to choose, now, let's talk about that. This is sort of more standard stuff that people already know how to do. This is a more interesting thing. We're going to try to trigger on something happening in the IBL, which is this inner layer over here on the tracker, which is put in just to improve beta inefficiencies. And essentially, it's really, really close to the beam one, just what we care about, just 31 millimeters. And the reason why we care about it is because it really catches even the softest particles in the spectrum. And also, like, because it's so close to the interaction point, our particles didn't have a chance to diffuse out a lot yet. And so we'll see like a very dense population. This is the number, the total number of hits on the IBL that we get for background, which is gray, essentially completely pilot dominated. So in reality, there's like a Z-post jet or a die jet that comes in from the level one trigger, but it doesn't really matter. Just for counting the amount of hits. And you see that even for a 751, there's already a significant shift, meaning my eye see that something is going on. For 125, for hits, it's a little bit of a more mild effect. But the key point is that the geographical separation of where these hits land is very different for pileup and for the signal. So this is the key point. For pileup, because it's like multiple different directed shifts that contribute, this is sort of more of a spread out kind of thing. This is gray haze, all these gray dots here are pileup. And in the z direction here, this is sort of this gray kind of Gaussian around zero, which is fairly wide. Now the signal, there's a lot of hits coming from one interaction point, which is all this blue stuff, right? And so they're very, very densely localized, and you have this giant peak here sitting at the position where the bomb actually went off. And because we were chrome and tonight is our jet, you see here there's a jet sitting right here, and chrome against it, that's a little bit fine. But we're not even going to use that because this is like already really spectacular. So you can come doing on time, probably. Oh shit, I'm talking super fast. I just cursed on camera. All right, thanks. I slow me down. So okay, getting back to what I'm saying. You have this giant open density over here. And the key point is not necessarily that it is so high, but the variance is very different. It's a very, very high correlation to the variance in background. And so that's what you see over here. This is a correlation matrix for the z-coordinate. You see a very high correlation for the 715 benchmark, and like it's much more mild for the background. And you can use this to construct Fisher discriminant, which is essentially the variable you use to separate two distributions with different variables and different means. And you see the background signals very well separated for 750, a little bit less for 400, and for the Higgs, it's not great. It's like roughly percent level efficiency. So it might require a 1% background injection. So again, it is important here to realize that I don't need to reduce signal to background to an arbitrary amount. I just need to reduce it to an amount that is manageable the way today, right? Which corresponds to 10 to the minus 3 times 10 to the minus 4, depending on how much bandwidth you want to use for today. For 10 to the minus 3, this one is 100% efficient, this one about 50, and this one is still relatively efficient. But there's another, perhaps more intuitive, and cleaner variable that I like that you can use, which is not make use of entire data, but it's a little bit more intuitive in some sense. We just pick the bin with the highest amount of hits for each of them, and we open a 6-centimeter window for that, just roughly this green shaded area. And for this sort of big bin here, we compute the observed amount of hits over the expected hits from background only. And these are the distributions that you get. Of course, the background peaks around 1, as it should. And then the signals are these other things. So the advantage of the variable is that it does not, the x-axis does not depend on the signal benchmark that you chose. So you can put like sort of a universal cut, depending on where you want to cover the background, and just find efficiencies. So this thing ends up performing better than the previous one. So again, essentially 100% efficient for this red thing over here, and for the green one, which is the Higgs, you still have like roughly 6% efficiency, which is not bad, given that there's only like a couple hundred extra tracks compared to that one, which has like 6,000 or 7,000 tracks. But it's really the fact that there will be more deep that does it for. Alright, yes.
Is it the peakiness, or is it also that you're just getting more tracks out of these higher?
Yeah, so this variable combines both, right, to some extent. Of course, like the higher the speed, the more this thing is going to shift over here. But then what also helps is that often this peak is a bit off center, right? The background tends to peak like in one of the central pins, while this thing just depends on where the event essentially should place, which is on average. At the center, of course, but like the variance is much bigger than just for this average of all these pilot points. So yeah, this tries to combine all these things. Yeah. All right. So then we can combine all the efficiencies just to get like a final answer. Right? For these two more spectacular benchmarks, we can do well. We have 20% or 10% efficiency, which again is about it's. It used to be zero, right? So this is quite good. For the Higgs, we have 4%, 4.0, sorry. Which is not great. And you can compare that with the efficiency that you just get from just doing associative production and triggering on a hard neuron, which is about 6%. And if you sort of fold in the cross-sections, this is combined VDF, UMP, and associative production. Yeah, not sure. Sort of compare other weights, right? So if given a choice, you have to do one of them, you probably just want to stick with at the moment with sort of more simple associate production treatment popular ones working out. But for these benchmarks, there's nothing at the moment, other than just a minimum bias trigger, which is very, very huge. Yeah, so essentially this is almost an online analysis. There's still some offline stuff that you need to do. It carries out fairly fast. Alright, that's it. I finished early. I'm sorry. Talked too fast. For heavy ions, you can look for ops. And this Z is just huge.
and we have a trigger for finally looking for this very strong coupled hidden valleys. If you're looking for really coupled hidden valleys, I don't see why you shouldn't look for strong coupled valleys. Anyways, that's it.
Yeah, any other questions?
So, have people observed the beyond their production and the state diagram start with one of the neurons is stuck for the world? The same thing that we did when we explained us with the election pairs, we can produce them. Yes, cells.
Yes,
as a good answer.
Yes, the rate is very large. And the rate is very large to the extent that your statistics is really good. Of course, the neurons are also very good to measure.
Right.
And at the moment, they think they have the, some people claim that they have the theory uncertainty in this calculation well enough under control to use the this neural measurement as a luminosity measurement for heavy ion collisions. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't want to make a claim on whether or not that's realistic, but like, it's the order of where the uncertainty is on.
The neuron orbit is already inside the nucleus.
So I think Maxim was asking, so you were saying you had this process before where you produce an electron cluster pair and one of the electrons, the electron binds to.
Oh, that process.
Yeah,
that's
So another neon pair production, but
oh, I don't think that's a difference by
something. Because I could probably turn it into a measurements of the charge radii or charge compactors and so on. Because it sort of probes already the charges to push
I don't think that's a nerve, but we can look it up. It's fine.
So, say, the appearance of the single loop loss.
Because then
that would be an interesting
situation. So the rate between electrons and muons drops quite rapidly. Just because it's very sensitive to the mass. Right?
Yeah, of course. So it's all done by 1/200 squared, that it is, right?
Yeah, and then well, more because the PDF falls very fast. Of course, the PDF. So it really needs a very low energy value. That would be interesting. One other thing that they is like roughly in, I haven't thought of what it uses, but like asymptotically, they'll collect by. A million, maybe 10 million tactile pairs, which is small compared to what that Bell would be able to do, actually, that kind of review. Maybe your result would do to use that. Maybe tactile pairs or something. But yeah, the cross sections are right. When I say kilobars, this is the usual cross section without cuts. So once you put HEPA cards, this drops by several orders of magnitude, so you're talking about the order of like 10 to 100 microbarns. The one sort of interesting theory thing that people have been thinking about for this electron cross-section is that you're essentially like, you start to sort of push into the unitarity, it starts to become a unitary calculation. So what you have to do is you have to account for the fact that you can produce multiple plus and minus pairs in a single collision. So the average amount of plus and minus pairs that are produced in a single collision is roughly 4 or 5. Most of those are too soft to run solutions for non pipe. But the rate is that large that you have to actually unitarize your cross
section. For the trigger stuff, maybe you mentioned this, but what's the status of these kind of, I forget if it was Atlas or CMS or both that wanted to do these basic level thing where you just get some fraction of all the events
regardless of what you're using. You mean
minimum bias triggers? Yeah. Is that happening or is it?
Well, I mean, it's happening even if they don't do anything, right? Or what do you mean?
No, yeah. I thought they wanted to save, you know, some very small fraction of random events on tape.
Oh, they always do that. Yeah, they have to do that for calibration purposes, for standard models.
Okay. So,
yeah.
Are there any bounds on those kinds of things?
No, so you're not. So one thing they can do, and that you proposed, is you can look for new physics in pilot events. Suppose you have a signal which is very difficult to trigger on,
mm-hmm.
And there was just another, you know, a WW was produced in another vertex.
Yeah.
Accidentally triggered on that WW, and you can now look for, you know.
Yeah.
So that starts to be efficient. If you're developing a new trigger and you find that you cannot beat something like 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 4 in efficiency,
yeah.
Then, you know, this starts to be.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is like several orders of magnitude worse than this. But that's like the ultimate fallback. If you really, really can't trigger on it, just look at whatever data you have that was recorded
by
accident.
Exactly.
And yeah. you can do that. Yeah. But that's not close to this one.
CMS is some program I'm not quite sure. They call it like scouting, right?
Yes, this is what we're proposing, is essentially
yes,
scouting. So what they're doing at the moment, and they're working actively on putting in more stuff, which is why we're very interested in doing this sort of things now, is to look for digests. Essentially, the digest search is so good at the moment, like it's so simple, they know how to do it well. They can actually do it almost online, or some variants of it, they can do it online, and they just write out the answer and throw away all the intermediate steps. They calibrate the detector online, they just write out, okay, this will be very nice, done. And then you can make a plot, and you can search for bumps. And you can, they said the best limits below 500 GeV come from scouting. And this is essentially a form of scouting. It's sort of a little bit in the middle, since we still propose to write it out today.
Right.
Sort of an intermediate kind of thing. So when Atlas was thinking of, they were saying that, well, you know, maybe we should just, you know, we can implement this kind of thing, just monitor it online, right? And if we see that the rate goes up pretty steady, you know, we can take care of it. But LCD will be able to eventually do everything online, which is really amazing. Right? So they will, and this is something as a theorist to think about, right? Because, you know, this is a capability that currently before it didn't exist, right? So you can actually you have a turbulence experiment provided that you think of your measurement beforehand. Right. That's the key thing. They can do the entire analysis online, but you have to tell them in advance what they should be looking for. And so this is Jesse's favor in MIT Bureau to look for dark photons. It takes advantage of that. Yeah, I think that this is cool stuff, tremendous stuff, and this is stuff that we should be doing, because otherwise, you know, doesn't help to have a triggerless experiment if, you know, we don't divide it with the options to use it. Anyway, I probably talked for a long time.
Okay, so that's good.